From the studios of WHQR Wilmington, this is Coastline, WHQR's weekly talk show featuring your local guests plus your Thursday questions and comments via calls and emails. I'm Cleve Callison. I'm sitting in today for Rachel Lewis Hilburn. And our topic today is innovation and change in language. There's one thing that each of us is more familiar with than anyone else in the world, and that is our own particular language and the way we speak it. Most of us are accustomed to using different languages, however, when talking to parents, children, spouses, partners, coworkers, friends, etc. So how do we know when to switch gears? When we hear a new word, how do we know when we should incorporate it, or do we reject it? And how do all these different streams come together in a given population speaking a language? And what drives changes in language as time goes on? Innovation and change in language is our topic today. My guests are Dr. Kirk Hazen, who is professor of linguistics in West Virginia University's Department of English and director of the West Virginia Dialect Project. Kirk Hazen, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you for having me.
And I understand that you have a class to teach at 1 o'clock today, so you're going to be present for the first two segments of our show. And you're not actually in West Virginia. You're in Kentucky. Is that right?
I am in Kentucky right now for the Linguistic Society of America Summer Institute. It's sort of like Vulcan Science Academy for linguists. And it's being hosted
Long and prosper.
Yes. Being hosted this year by the University of Kentucky, who has so wonderfully set me up here for this phone call.
Oh, well, that's great. And our thanks to them also. We're also joined here in the studio by Dr. Amanda Boomershein, Associate Professor of Spanish at UNCW. Amanda Boomershein, welcome to Coastline.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here. Have you been on our show before?
No.
No, you haven't. Okay. Well, we're glad you're here. And we'll be joined later in the show by Ben Steelman, Star News reporter and columnist, as well as the organizer and host of WHQR's live prologue events, book discussions held once a month on Monday night at the MC Ernie Gallery here at WHQR. I welcome you and our audience to join our Thursday conversation for the next hour. Let us hear from you with your emails to coastline@whqr.org or give us a call at any time at 910-343-1138. Do you have a question or comment for our guests? Are you curious about an example in language of something that's new for you? What are some of your favorite or least favorite examples of words that are new or traditional for that matter? And would you describe yourself as a language innovator or a language traditionalist? Again, now's your chance. You can call 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. Kirk Hazen, I'd like to start with you. We talked about innovation and tradition. How do innovations in language start?
In numerous different ways, usually with teenagers, but with words, anybody can start them. For lots of sounds, changes in vowels perhaps, it's often teenagers pushing some ongoing variation in new directions.
Wouldn't part of the dynamic there be that they don't want their parents to pick up this language because that would admit parents into this secret society that teenagers have?
It seems to be a regular theme that every generation wants to separate itself off from the generation before. So they take little bits of variation. It could be the a vowel in bat, and maybe they raise it up to something like bet. And that little bit of push can make a social difference. And if they can do that, then they can distinguish themselves.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes the differences in sounds can be quite subtle, but they do serve as markers to differentiate people who are within the group or outside the group.
It's a common theme for all humans across the globe. We use language variation, different dialects, to mark ourselves socially. So it's one of our most common themes in human language.
Mm-hmm. Are there different times when innovation is stronger or when tradition is stronger? Different cultures where one takes precedence over the other?
So tradition usually comes up with written forms. most of the world's languages have not had any kind of written form. So there the traditions go with oral histories. But it, really, traditions are enforced with written forms because it's kind of cultural invention that is maintained and can be overtly groomed and formally taught. A lot of innovations come up with different kinds of population density, larger cities and areas. So there are times where innovations go forward more quickly, but overall, it's a slow, steady march.
Well, Kirk Hazen, we know that your specialty is dialects and the development of dialects. Amanda Boomershine, is this something that you have studied with respect to Spanish, the development of the language and the variations in the language?
Yes, definitely. Because there are so many Spanish-speaking countries in the world and so many different Spanish speakers living here in the U.S. and in North Carolina from different countries and different with different language varieties, it's very easy to see variation in Spanish, especially variation in Spanish in contact with English.
Would that be like people in California who might originate from Mexico versus people in the East who might come from Cuba or places like that?
Yeah, definitely.
Significant differences are there between different flavors of Spanish there?
For sure. And even within, if you look at people who are originally from Mexico on the West Coast, who for generations and generations have been living in what is now the U.S., versus immigrants in North Carolina who are first or second generation from Mexico, we can see differences in their Spanish just because of the generational differences. Mm-hmm. But definitely we have differences in Cuban Spanish, Puerto Rican Spanish, Iberian Spanish from Spain. Yes, lots of variation there.
I'm curious about the phenomenon of second and third generation people whose parents or grandparents, of course, spoke Spanish as their native language. Did they usually grow up bilingual, or did they focus only on Spanish and learn English later, or the other way around?
Yeah, it really depends on where they live in the U.S. or whatever their new country is. Here in North Carolina, we're seeing that because English is such a dominant language within our community, the immigrants usually maintain Spanish as their dominant language. Second generation, so the kids who were born here, they tend to be dominant in English, but maintain Spanish usually, depending on who watched them as kids, if they have older siblings or not, that's a huge issue. And then by third generation, so the children of the kids who are born here, they're almost always going to be monolingual English with very little Spanish.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned about population density. So does that mean if there are lots of people speaking Spanish in this culture, you're more likely to do it, whereas if you're more or less kind of isolated with that, the children would be more likely to develop English not do the Spanish?
Okay. So no matter what, they're going to learn English, and it's going to be their dominant language just because English is the dominant language for most of the U.S., and that's definitely the case for all of North Carolina. But what we do find is that it depends on how many different domains where they can speak Spanish. And so if they can go to church in Spanish, if they have a community surrounding them where they can practice Spanish, if they have grandparents here who don't speak English and they have to have Spanish to be able to communicate with them, then that increases their chances to be able to maintain their home language.
You're listening to Coastline. Our topic is innovation and tradition in language with guests Dr. Kirk Hazen and Dr. Amanda Boomershine. Ben Steelman will be joining us later in this program. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a call at 910-343-1138. Or, I started to say you could make your pledge online at WHQR.org, which you could still do, but I'm slipping in inevitably into fundraising mode here. You can write to us at coastline@WHQR.org. Now, mention, we did have someone who wrote in a few minutes ago, and I don't know if this is really in the wheelhouse of either of you, but the question is from George in Wilmington, who says, please reflect on the patois. I have seen books on the grammar of Jamaican patois. Is this really an alternative grammar? And I guess this question is sort of, what do we mean when we say grammar? But would either of you care to tackle the Jamaican question?
Right. With this kind of variety, it is actually a creole. So this is a language that has developed over time with English words but with all kinds of West African grammatical influences. So it is a separate variety, a separate language in that way. And as with all languages, it's systematic. So, yes, it can have its own grammar and should be studied in the same way as any other variety.
Mm-hmm. So it's, to simplify this, if I'm hearing what you say correctly, that the grammar, underlying grammar of this is likely to be from West African roots, but the vocabulary is English words.
Correct. That's the basic idea. When these languages come together as pidgins early on, what you have are adults doing the best they can with different words, but they don't share a common language. So they have to create their own in very trying situations. Over generations, children eventually supply the grammar, and some of that grammar is coming from West African influences.
You used the word pidgin a minute ago. I don't think I've seen that word, as speaking of tradition and innovation, I don't think I've seen that as commonly as Creole. Is there a difference between pidgin and Creole?
Professor Boomershine, would you like that one?
Yeah, sure, definitely.
Okay.
So a pidgin is when you have, like Kirk was saying, when you have speakers of different languages in contact, usually over trade or through migration of people or forced migration of people. A pidgin is when they kind of come together and it's like a de facto language that they kind of make on their own. And then when their kids start speaking that language natively, it becomes
their language.
Yeah, it becomes a language. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. We're going to take a short break, and we'll come back in just a moment with the rest of today's program. You're listening to Coastline on this station, WHQR. Our phone number for your questions and comments about tradition and innovation in language is 910-343-1138, and our email address is coastline@whqr.org. We'll be back after a short break. Welcome to Coastline on WHQR. I'm Cleve Callison, sitting in today for Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Our topic today, innovation and tradition in language. How do languages change? Why do they change? Why do they stay in a fixed state for a while? And what motivates this sort of change? We're looking at these various topics and would love to have your examples of things that you have noticed or things that you're curious about. So you can get in touch with us with your phone call to 910-343-1138, or you can send an email to coastline@whqr.org. I'm joined in the studio by Dr. Amanda Boomershine. She's an associate professor of Spanish here at UNCW in Wilmington. And on the line with us is Dr. Kirk Hazen. He's a professor of linguistics at West Virginia University's Department of English and director of the West Virginia Dialect Project. So we welcome both of them to the program and encourage you to give us a call, 910-343-1138. And there's one more term I would like to see if we can define. Amanda, you were saying that Kirk, we were talking about pidgin versus Creole, and that pidgin is sort of the language of convenience that can be used. For example, a classic example would be trading partners, I guess, in the South Seas or something like that with different languages. But it can become a real Creole with an actual flourishing language after a generation or two. So how would we define patois? That was the name that was used in the email question that we got. Is there an official definition for that? It sounds like that's what they call it in Jamaica, but...
Yeah, so usually a label for a variety, for a modern Creole, not necessarily derogatory, certainly one often associated with the Jamaican Creole.
Mm-hmm. Kirk Hazen, you're only going to be with us for the remainder of this particular segment, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions, particularly about your work. You're a professor of dialect studies, or a focus on dialect studies, and I guess you must have fertile grounds for that kind of study in West Virginia.
It's a nice area to study. It's actually been understudied in the last few decades. So there's plenty of variation to go around. The one thing about the area is that it's often assumed to be just one variety over the entire state, and that has not been true at any point. There are regional differences, and then there's all kinds of social differences within even the sub-regions. So there's a very healthy dose of variation across the state.
And I would imagine it's not only geographically, but there must be cultural and class differences, and maybe even differences between valley people and hill people in a state like West Virginia.
Yeah, there's certainly rural versus town differences, and those are some of the most sharp. There are social class differences, just as with any other area. One thing you find throughout the English-speaking world is that the rate of what's called G-dropping, using walk-in instead of walk-ing, varies by social class very systematically across the entire English-speaking world. And in West Virginia, it works exactly the same way. So despite Appalachia's disposal being so different, many of the systems work just like in other areas.
So when kids go to school and the teacher tries to teach them to speak correctly, they're going to emphasize trying to put the G on the end of the words.
Yeah, it's questionable how much spoken language gets corrected in schools. Schools are mainly designed to work with written genre conventions. And that kind of formal instruction can be taught. It can be graded. The lessons are not always that titillating for students, but they're formal things that can be assessed. Mm-hmm. With spoken language, they might work on formal presentations and have such things such as G-dropping come up. But most of the time, that kind of variation is regulated by teenage groups. Be it in Spanish in North Carolina or English in West Virginia, it's the teenagers more than the family and more than the teachers that have the main influence.
Amanda Boomershine, do you see that same thing in studies of Spanish, that the language of the teenagers will differ in terms of accent or how it's pronounced from that of their parents?
Yes, definitely. I think, as Kirk was saying earlier, teenagers always want to kind of push a little bit on societal norms, and one way they can do that easily is through language. Mm-hmm. And so we definitely see that in Spanish as well.
Okay. Kirk, I have to say I found a very interesting article that our producer, Isabel Shepherd, sent over to me, where you're talking about examples of different types of idioms or different types of language that one might hear in West Virginia that would be considered, I guess, non-standard. And one was language that, like, I done folded the clothes. Could you talk about a little bit? Why does that come in?
Sure. So in many varieties of English, you can show a completed action by using have and a form of the verb. So I have walked, and it shows that walking is complete.
Those modals.
Yeah. So with that kind of perfect form, there have been innovations in the South and with African-American English where the done can be used to show that completed action. So it's a different way to show the perfect aspect. In Southern varieties and in some Southern varieties of Appalachia, you have complete of done where, you know, I done washed the dishes instead of I have washed the dishes. And it shows the completedness of the action. It can be socially stigmatized, but it can also feel very much like home and family, depending on who's doing it.
And sort of the implication, like there's like a final statement, like, well, that job is over and done with. You know, that it's kind of the implication that I get from that.
Right. Absolutely. It shows that perfect aspect in there. So it serves a perfectly good grammatical function. How it's socially evaluated might be different.
Mm-hmm. Let's try another one of these. I'm a fixin' to make a change.
Yes, very much a Southern feature. Actually does not reach up all that far into the northern parts of West Virginia or Pennsylvania, perhaps in some rural areas. But, yeah, some real regional divides on this. Fixin' to itself is a widely used Southern verb. The in front of it, is called a prefixing, and it's a feature that is used in Appalachia probably more in performative speech, when it's you're actually performing the speech to represent the variety, more than it's used in any regular conversation nowadays.
Okay.
It used to be more common.
Yeah. We might come back to a couple of these because I find them really fascinating. I have to tell you, I have a PhD from the University of Wisconsin, and
nice.
One of my dissertation advisors was Fred Cassidy, who was the originator of the Dictionary of American Regional English, the late Fred Cassidy. I don't know if you knew him personally.
Yes, I did meet him several times.
Yeah, he was a wonderful man. He really was. And actually, I think he was from Jamaica, curiously enough, speaking Jamaican earlier.
He had all kinds of expertise down there, yes.
Yeah, oh, great. So I find this sort of thing fascinating. I'm glad to talk to both of you about this. I'm Cleve Callison. You're listening to Coastline on WHQR. We're talking about tradition and innovation in language and with our guests, and they are Dr. Amanda Boomershine from UNCW and Dr. Kirk Hazen from West Virginia University. And Ben Steelman will join us a little bit later. We have a comment here that came in. He didn't want to stay on the line, but John from Leland called. When did everybody start beginning explanations with the word so? I've noticed this in the last year or so among younger people, and it drives me crazy. Either of you familiar with that? We hear it all the time, but on NPR, NPR people do it all the time.
I am familiar with that one, but Professor Boomershine, you want to take that first?
What I can say about that is that it's a discourse marker, and a lot of times people use discourse markers if they need to borrow a little bit more time to get ready for what they're going to say, or it's just something that happens that you kind of do over time and it builds into your speech. Kirk can talk a little bit more about the English side of that, specifically with so.
Well, by discourse marker, would it be similar to like the word well?
Well,
I was reading something the other day. It was an analysis of the speech patterns of our current president, Donald Trump, and it was pointing out that he almost never begins speeches, unlike many politicians who begin with the word well when answering a question, he almost never does that. Mm. And the speculation was, or the interpretation was, this may be one reason why he's perceived as being more direct, because to some people, well sounds a little bit like, stumping for time here. I'm trying to think of my answer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense to either of you?
Definitely.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
Good.
Yeah.
So to go back to so.
It has a long tradition in different ways, and Professor Boomershine is exactly right about the discourse markers here. It's a way to take the floor, wave your hand, and say, I'm stepping up, I'm about to talk. So it's a way to grab the floor. This kind of thing, if you think all the way back to Beowulf, and you start
Waegardena.
Exactly. Uh-huh. You start there, and Seamus Haney translated that as so.
Mm-hmm.
So is something actually not, that you pointed out, I do all the time in my talk. I have constrained it some because people have noticed it every once in a while. One of my librarians, Joe Brown at my West Virginia University Library, noted it one time. And I had no idea that I did it that often.
Yeah.
So I do vary it up more. But yes, it seems to be quite a trend, and it is certainly something that many people have picked up. And these things come and go. I know some people might take them up as pet peeves, but when they are on the rise, there's pretty much nothing to stop it. And there's certainly nothing systematically wrong with that kind of usage.
Yeah. And certain things are just in vogue for a while, and they may last or they may not. We have another question here. By the way, if you want to get in touch with us, our phone number is 910-343-1138. And our email address is coastline@whqr.org. We have a question here that came in from Lindsay, sent us an email to coastline@whqr.org. She says, could you speak a little bit about the benefits of dual language education for both English language learners and Spanish language learners? Let's give this to Amanda.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So I can start with the... Yeah. Yep.
There you go.
Just formulating my response here. So so I'll start with the English students. Students who come in speaking English or coming from an English-dominant home. When they're exposed to a second language, be it Spanish or another language, from early on, you know, 5 years, 4 years, 6 years old, there are definitely cognitive benefits that have been shown that will last a lifetime. But in addition, they're, and almost as importantly, in my opinion, is they're exposed to other cultures, because through having a teacher who is a native speaker of Spanish and hopefully being in class with native speakers of Spanish, they have that increased cultural awareness from a very young age, which can do nothing but help us as a society. And then if we look at the other half of the classroom, or the other kids in the class who come from Spanish-dominant homes, those kids definitely benefit from being exposed to their home language, because they'll have literacy in both languages, both Spanish and English. And then they'll also get to be in a class where they are helping to teach their home language, which for a lot of Spanish speakers, or it could be other languages in other parts of the country, they aren't awfully often given that opportunity to be a teacher for something in the classroom. They're usually the ones that are learning from other kids. But
so you really see this kind of bilingual process as a real aid to education and learning about the culture all around.
Absolutely. And something I forgot to mention, which for me is obvious but may not be for some of our listeners if they haven't thought about it too much. My children happen to both go to the school here in town, the public school that has a dual language program, Spanish and English. So it's been on my mind for years. But the kids who come from English-only homes or English-dominant homes, they will have native-like Spanish pronunciation and grammar and lexicon by the time they leave elementary school. And that's just amazing. That's a gift that we can give to these kids in addition to all the other cognitive and social benefits that they get. So
okay.
And it's much better to start them early than to wait until they're 14 and then try to hit them with books.
Right. The ability to learn a language fluently really disappears pretty early in people's life, doesn't it? It's something about the way our brains are wired.
Definitely.
We have a caller on the line. You're listening to Coastline. Our number is 910-343-1138. We're going to say hello to Amadou from Wilmington. Amadou, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, Cleve. Retirement is always a good thing, but I'm sad to see you go.
No, well, thank
you.
I've got eight more days left.
I come from West Africa, and I speak several versions of what would amount to our lingua franca, patois, or Creole. So what's clear is that in Nigeria and other urban centers in that region, they speak a different patois, which is really a trade language. In Gambia and Sierra Leone, it's more of a home language. And when we come from Gambia and Sierra Leone and hear Nigerians speak, we can tell clearly there's a difference between our version of what we call Creole and theirs. So that's very clear in West Africa.
So you can actually identify the region or the country where people come from, even though they're speaking the same language and a language that you understand, just by virtue of the accents that they have and so forth?
Clearly, when I hear somebody, a Nigerian, speak their own version of what I would label a lingua franca or urban patois, I can clearly tell where they come from. When African from my region speak it, even if I don't ask, I can tell almost where he comes from, whether Gambia or Sierra Leone.
How long have you lived in this country, Amadou?
I went to college here 30 years plus, but I do go back and forth.
Okay, very good. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, please.
Mm-hmm. Any comments, either of you, about that?
It goes to show how well all of us use language variation to figure out social differences. And the variety itself doesn't matter. If you're familiar with what the social marker is, it's something that shows up and you readily recognize.
We're talking about innovation and tradition in language on today's Coastline. And our guests are Dr. Kirk Hazen from West Virginia University and Dr. Amanda Boomershein from here at UNCW. The number to call, 910-343-1138, or go online and make your call to us on the phone, or send us an email to coastline@whqr.org. Okay, we're going to say hello to our next caller, who is Bob from Wilmington. Bob, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just wondering about what your guests would have to say about certain phrases used in Piedmont, North Carolina. My father retired from the Army when I was ready for high school, and I went through a little country high school in Davidson County. And my classmates used phrases like might could, meaning might be able to, or to look at TV instead of to watch it. You could cut something half in two. And they use the word yonder a lot, and also over yonder in combination, meaning something that's beyond what you can see up ahead. I'd like to hear if that's, is that related to Tudor English, as I assumed, or what is it?
So some of these are innovations, and some of them certainly have connections to past. But the one with the might could is what are called double modals. So if you ever Google double modals, there's all kinds of discussions out there on it. It's a usage that can be show different levels of hypothetical, and it's certainly a Southern feature. It's a widespread Southern feature, so it can be in throughout most of the South. Something like look at TV is a lexical variation. The kind we expect to find all over the United States. The yonder certainly is one where these kinds of markers of distance do have older roots, but so do many words like man, woman, fire, and water. So, yeah, there are connections. It's a question of which regions dropped and then which regions continue them on. But yeah, yonder is one used both in Appalachia and in the South. Right. It's nice that there was a distinction between different levels of distance away with that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We're going to have
Thank
you for your call, Bob. We're going to have to take a break here. I will say that yonder goes all the way back to Old English. That was my field of study.
Yep.
So that's a very old word in our language. We'll be back later with the next segment of today's Coastline.
Thank you.
Welcome to Coastline on WHQR. This is the final segment of today's program. I'm Cleve Callison, sitting in today for Rachel Lewis Hilburn. And our topic is innovation and tradition in language. Your questions about changes that you've noticed in language, changes that you like or changes that you don't like, give us a call here at the station with your question, 910-343-1138. Our guests in this final segment, we've had to say goodbye to Dr. Kirk Hazen from West Virginia University. We appreciate his comments to this program and his contributions. And we welcome, in addition to Amanda Boomershein, Ben Steelman from the Star News. Hey, Ben.
Thank you.
Glad to have you here. You have a lifelong interest in language and in words related to your professional interests, but you're probably personally very interested in these things, too.
Well, one thing I noticed, I'm an old WHQR listener, and I remember the old commentaries that Claude Howell used to give.
Right.
And you remember Claude's talk.
Oh, yes.
How he would just drawl off those words.
Oh, yeah.
Like he was a character in a Tennessee Williams play. And you notice that his old friend Henry J. McMillan talked the same way. In fact, lots and lots of people of Claude's generation talked that way. And people don't anymore. And apparently one reason for that was that Claude and all the little white kids when he was growing up were largely raised by African-American ladies who were working in the home as maids and cooks and were picking up some of these African-American speech patterns.
Huh.
So that you sort of had this this connection or combination there, and it's just not happening anymore.
No, it's not. That's a big change. Yeah. If you have a question or comment about language, we'd like to hear from you. 343-1138. We have a comment here from Mary Beth, and this is something I'm going to ask Amanda Boomershein about this one. He says, I have noticed that sometimes when people are talking or giving a workshop or explaining an idea or process or concept, They often make a statement and then end it with the word right. Sometimes they raise their voice and make it almost sound like a question. Then they keep on talking. And wonder if you have noticed this or if you see a particular type of language trend with tech folks or IT folks. I see. She's got IT in lowercase. I didn't realize that's what she meant, but that's what you're referring to.
Yeah.
Do you know what she's talking about?
Yeah,
have you heard
so
it?
She's talking about tag questions. Uh-huh. So tag questions are just little, like, yeah, right, really, yes, no, mm-hmm. that you would kind of add on to the end of a statement just to make sure that the person that we're talking to is on board with us, that they're still paying attention, and that they agree. It's kind of used in the same way that discourse markers can be used sometimes to get more time or to really just make sure that we're all going along the conversation the same way. I don't know if tech people use it more than others, but it's definitely something that is used throughout the U.S., and not only in English, but in different languages as well. Everyone uses tag questions.
Well, to me, I think they're two different things. She is talking about what you're talking about, but I've noticed another phenomenon, and I have to say I think this is particularly common in academia. And, you know, I've interviewed a number of people who it's not a question. It doesn't have a question inflection. It's mm-hmm. I've been studying the works of Shakespeare, right? And then I'm going to go to some, you know, it's mm-hmm. it's like not a question, and it's inserted in the middle of two things. Have mm-hmm. you know what I'm talking
yeah,
about?
Yeah, so that would be more.
I was in my car listening to a program that we carry, which shall not be named, and I heard someone say this 14 times in the space of 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. I started counting.
Yep, so that would be an example of a discourse marker. Uh-huh. And so it just could be something we tend to have certain discourse markers that we personally hold on to. Kirk was saying he uses so. Uh-huh. A lot. That person apparently uses right. Younger people tend to use like. Yes. A lot. And so every kind of
and
generation.
You know,
yeah, you know.
You know is still around.
Mm-hmm. Right. So.
There you go.
Yes. So back to discourse markers and their use, their role in language.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It can be a little bit, I guess, aggressive. Like, so we're going to cover this topic, right? And we all understand it, so we don't have to talk about this anymore, right?
Uh-huh.
So anyway.
And a version of that you'll hear sometimes is, am I right? Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes said very quickly.
Yeah.
You're wanting people to agree with you or to go along with you. Here's another comment that has come into our email address. Mark says, in Northeastern North Carolina, we grew up using won't to mean wasn't, WASNT. Like if you were blamed for something, you'd say, it won't me. I'm sure you've heard that.
Or yeah. You won't be trying that no more.
Very good. Thank you, Mark. Let's see. We had a question from Fatima from Wilmington, who is no longer on the line. Why do teenagers say sentences as though they're a question?
Ah.
With that rising inflection. Any comment about that, Amanda?
Yeah. So it's just something that they have adopted. It's kind of, it used to be called Valley Girl speak.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Out of California area, but it's kind of spread across the entire U.S. now, and it's more of a generational feature. Oh. And it's something
that's more generational?
Yes.
Sorry, I can't do it very well.
Yeah.
It's been a while since I've been a teenager.
Right. And so, yeah, it's just a marker that they have. It's a way that they kind of distinguish their speech from others.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think, to go back to the question of innovation versus tradition, I think every tradition that we now have was an innovation at one time in
Absolutely.
The history of our language.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's one that's likely to persist? It seems to be growing all the time.
Yeah.
Or is it going to be just a fad like 23 Skidoo, which nobody says anymore?
Right, yeah. So it's up to society. It's all based on societal norms and being accepted by the society. So if enough speakers start adopting that usage, then yeah, it'll definitely be a norm instead of an innovation. So we will
But you're
see.
Not taking bets on that
Oh,
yet.
No.
Okay. Let's see, we have, Isabel, our producer, is on the line here, and she says it's uptalk, and it's used to communicate that they're continuing their comment, right? As in, they used to say, I'm still talking, let me finish what I'm saying, you know, that mm-hmm. sort of thing.
For sure.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, for sure.
F-E-R-S-H-O-O-R. I have a question.
Yeah.
How is the internet changing speech patterns?
Well, we have an expert here.
I, You know, I would say that the internet is definitely affecting speech and language. The internet allows us to be in contact with many more varieties than we maybe would have been in contact with before. And then also we have social media. And so texting and Facebook, and the language used in social media is very different from traditional written language. And then people tend to sometimes adopt that into their speech as well. So I hear,
like, saying LOL.
LOL or BTW. And it kind of catches me, and I have to stop and say, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. Or ask one of my kids, what does that mean? But yes, definitely people are using just the increased contact with other varieties and other speakers through the internet mm-hmm. and social media. Mm-hmm.
We have an anonymous comment from Anonymous from Castle Hayne. Have the guests noticed an increase in saying, I mean? Don't know about that.
I do hear that.
I mean, it's been around for a while.
Yeah, it's not exactly brand new.
Yeah, but I would say that it's actually used more by women than men, which we find with a lot of different discourse markers and words like that. So women traditionally have wanted to make sure that their speech is accepted or what they're saying is accepted by the group. And so we'll say things like, oh, I mean, just to kind of clarify or soften. And so definitely I think that it's used, it's still being used in society and more so by men, women than men.
It's different from, you know what I mean? I hear that sometimes as asking for a kind of, I guess, affirmation or determining, am I on the right track here
right.
what I say?
Yeah, but by using I mean, I think that women can kind of have a chance to step back and retool what they were saying or come in line more with the other people they're speaking with if they're kind of not, they're sensing that they're perhaps not in agreement.
Okay. Let's go to, we're going to say hello to Jean-Paul from Wilmington. Jean-Paul, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, this is
Jean-Paul. Jean-Paul. Okay, sorry.
Yeah, this is a question for Dr. Boomershine. I would like to know if, and really for all of your speakers in general, if in the circles in which they work professionally, if there is much talk about, especially now with the presence of online linguistics, this common language that's permeating social media, and international communication via the internet, if there is a concern or any general study about one common language emerging from social media internationally, globally, and is there a level of concern about that? I know there's always been in the past this concern of English taking over the world and the nuances of other languages disappearing. So where are things with that now?
Hi, Jean. Thanks for your question. You know, I think that that is probably of concern for some, especially for traditionalists who are less easily adapting to changes in language or variation. I think that the internet does allow more people to practice English, and English probably is used more in social media just because it is the language that many people speak in the world. That may change. As other countries come into power or more speakers of Mandarin or Cantonese and other languages. But I think that the internet is one realm or one domain, but then we still have our at home and within our own community where we will maintain our own languages. But definitely I think that's a concern for some, with globalization and other things, yeah.
Okay.
Great, thank you.
All right, thanks very much for your call. Boy, we've got several calls here. I've got other questions for you guys, but I think we'll jump ahead to some other callers here. Let's go to let's say hello to Jim from Oak Island. Jim, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, Cleve.
Hi.
I grew up in western Pennsylvania in an area that would probably be considered part of Appalachia, and then I lived most of my adult life in Piedmont, North Carolina. And I noticed both places, a lot of people, especially rural people, use the singular for distance measurements. Like, he is 6 foot tall, or it's about 4 miles from here. The only exception seems to be inches. I've never heard anybody say it's 4 inch. Is that
Well, as an adjective, you could do that. Like, you could say this is a 4-inch piece of copper or something like that. I would say from the standpoint, this is kind of a field that I was in, it's a very ancient usage. And what you have going on there with 6 foot is the numerical followed by a genitive plural whose ending has dropped off. In Anglo-Saxon, it would be sex fotra, and fotra is a plural, possessive plural. In other words, it means six of feet, but the ending of that word has dropped off entirely, so you're left with 6 foot. Ben, you look like you have a...
Not particularly. I was just going to
say... We've all heard this kind of thing he's talking about, though. Yeah,
exactly. I was just going to throw in off the side that for the gentleman from Davidson County, I can remember in my father pointing out that when he was growing up in the mountains, that people did not shop, they did not buy, they went to trade.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So,
do you think that goes back to literally when there was more bartering going on, or
quite likely,
perhaps the origin of that?
Perhaps.
Yeah. Well, there are all sorts of things. And Amanda, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Southern Virginia, outside of Richmond.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we're all Southerners. And I grew up in South Carolina, but mm-hmm. I've been working in radio so long, I probably have lost most of my Southern accent. Although living here in Wilmington, I'm glad to be able to use the word y'all without feeling guilty anymore. Let's get a call here. We're going to thank Jim from that. And we have another call here. This is coming from John in Wilmington. John, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Cleve. My question is, how do linguists feel in regards to what I will use, for lack of a better term, as a dumbing down of the King's English? For example, they've just recently, within the last couple of years, incorporated the word conversate into the dictionary. And it may be just a pet peeve of mine. That word drives me crazy because you can't converse and conversate. It has to be one or the other. Am I not tracking that correctly?
What's the word again that rubs you the wrong way here?
I'm sorry. Conversate.
Conversate. Okay.
Yes.
I just saw that one recently. I don't think I've ever actually heard it. I've seen it written, but mostly by people who are saying, I don't like it. Yeah. Amanda Boomershine, what about that?
Yeah, you know, I've never heard that word before or seen it written, but there are lots of other words that are coming into our language.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happens with languages that are still living, that we're constantly adding new words. So when that ends, then when we stop adding new words, then we'll have a dead language. So I think it's a good thing that we keep going and innovating. And, you know, I'm going to have to keep my ears open for that one.
Yeah. I will say, and by the way, thank you very much for the call, John. I will say, having studied language, and I'm sure you've seen this too, the one constant, the one thing you can always say is that languages always change over time. There's no such thing as a language that stays in its, quote, pure state. And most people tend to think that the pure state of a language is the one that they learned in grammar school. But people 3 or 4 generations before you would have learned a different pure state.
This raises a question you might be able to answer, Cleve. Isn't it a fact that English over time has like grown simpler, sort of quote unquote dumbed down than it was in its Anglo-Saxon form when there were more?
Well, I don't like the expression dumbed down because that's just a different way of saying changing. There are certain things that I find totally objectionable about when I hear them, innovations that I don't like at all. I'm sorry that the word disinterested can no longer be used in what I consider it to be its correct way, because to people now it means uninterested, which that to me, that's not what it's supposed to mean, and it's a perfectly good word. But you can't do anything about it. You know, Samuel Johnson said at length, the pen must comply with the tongue. Thank you very much for being our guest today, Dr. Amanda Boomershine and Ben Steelman from Star News. Glad to have you both here. Thanks to our callers. Sorry we couldn't get to everybody today. But you're listening to Coastline. Ken Campbell is our broadcast engineer today. Rachel Lewis-Hilburn, I'm sitting in for her. Isabel Shepherd is our producer and has been our email and telephone wrangler today. Thanks very much, and you'll hear a repeat of this program Sunday at 2 o'clock. Join us next week for Coastline on WHQR.